What's wrong with Russian tea?
Well, they tend to put things in it that are like polonium.
Ah, yes, of course. It shortens all of our misery, at least.
It's Friday, April the 19th, and this is the Dutch News Podcast, your weekly chance to catch up with what's been going on here in the Netherlands. I'm Gordon Darrow, Dutch News Contributing Editor, and Kate Snatching Koningsdagboer. And with me today is Shanai Bostas, journalist for The Guardian, The Sunday Times, and sundry others, and champion tile ripper.
Indeed I am a champion tile ripper.
Yes. What's happening with the tiles, Shen? Why are you ripping them? What have you done with them? What's the deal?
The latest socially responsible thing to do is actually to go around attacking pavements, as long as they belong to you, and ripping out the tiles and replacing them with green so that the whole city doesn't flood and you've got lots of lovely green to cheer you up and absorb all the water that's coming down and keep the city a bit cooler as well. So I've been talking to lots of people who are ripping out tiles in a national competition to try to...
Yeah.
Rip or whip or whatever, the most tiles in the Netherlands. You've been ripping tiles as well, haven't you?
I've taken some tiles up, though I have to say I've also been putting tiles down. So my net number of tiles is pretty much unchanged, although I've made a little... I built a shed back in the autumn, which I won't bore you the details of, but I did. My garden was not completely paved over. There's a nice little raised flower bed area, but then the rest of it is completely paved. But what I've done now is I've put a sort of gutter down the middle and filled it with stones, so that drains away much better than it did before.
That's okay.
So I'm happy.
Yeah. You get a few marks for that. Tell me about your Boer career. You've got a new job, journalism not paying well enough.
My career as a Boer, yes. Well, Koningsdag is coming up, and it is a day of joy and celebration for the whole country when people go out and try to flog their tat to their neighbours in little street markets. But I think our eyes are both caught by the rules that have been published by Amsterdam City Council this year, which, among other things, say that often when you go to these little stalls, people are selling like homemade cakes and pouring drinks and that kind of thing, right, which are all very nice and wholesome. But according to the city council, if you do this and you sell the cakes, you're actually supposed to have be registered with the Chamber of Commerce and have a license to have a catering license, effectively. Otherwise, you're breaking the rules. And you may find that the Boers going around in the city centre will come around and fine you.
Yes, because the city is quite short of money, so they need to raise it any way they can. More of that later.
Yeah, but because they're driving out all the tourists, they need to get the income from somewhere else now.
Exactly.
So, it's going to be cake.
Law-breaking cupcake bakers.
Law-breaking cupcake bakers, yeah. Heel Holland Betaald, I think this is called.
Very good.
That brings us all nicely round to the op-ed of the week, I think, which Paul has very kindly done for us, although Paul is sadly not with us today. He's busy doing more important things,
say he's taking a free holiday to Turkey?
Possibly, yes, because there are planes flying to Turkey, and if he does, I hope he makes sure he clears out the front pocket very diligently in his seat, because the op-ed this week is about the package airline Corendon, which is based in Turkey but actually is a Dutch-run business, and one of the owners or the CEO is a former D66 minister, Gunay Uzlu. And the NSA newspaper revealed this week that the airline has resumed flying Russian holidaymakers to the Turkish sun. So it's flying from Moscow to various Turkish beach resorts, despite the fact that Russian airspace has been closed to European airlines since February 2022. Something happened then, which completely changed relations between Russian businesses and the rest of Europe.
I think what that could be.
Yeah, anyway. I don't know. But certainly the Dutch government made a bigger play of it, including, of course, the D66 party. But since the beginning of April, Corendon has been flying daily from Moscow to Turkey under the name Fun and Sun.
God.
It's rather lovely, yeah. And the budget carrier even intends to increase the number of Russian departure cities to 10 in the summer. But of course, as we just mentioned, the Corendon CEO is the former junior minister for culture and media, Gunay Uzlu of D66. In December, she left the cabinet. She's one of several ministers who has quit since the cabinet collapsed in last July. And she took over the job as CEO because this was a company that was actually her family's business, and she was involved in founding it back before she went into politics. But this all made the OPEF particularly awkward, of course, because not only is D66 a party that campaigns for people to fly less and to pay more if they do fly, but also because, of course, they were the biggest critic of companies that circumvent Russian sanctions. Now, Corendon's spokesman was very keen to point out that Corendon Turkey and Corendon Netherlands are strictly separate companies and would refuse to answer any further questions when this was raised by NSA because he does not work for Corendon Turkey. But NSA did note that both companies are registered at the same address in Batuverdorp, and also they actually use the same planes to fly to holiday destinations. So the plane that lands in Moscow as a Corendon Turkey plane will then that's come from Moscow as a Corendon Turkey plane will then take off and fly to Amsterdam as a Corendon Netherlands plane. So yeah, if you're on a Corendon plane, just make sure, just check your seat for bugs before you depart, would be my advice.
And bullets.
And yes, and various other things, and possibly polonium as well, because that's nasty stuff if it gets on your hands. Oh no, that's the other one, that's Novichok. Anyway, the newspaper also found an advertisement for a resort in Kundu that is an exact copy of the Kremlin. Now this is a really eerie thing. Have you seen a photo of this, Shane?
I've seen it. It's quite extraordinary. Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. This is a Turkish beach resort with a swimming pool and just a model of the Kremlin right behind it. Yeah. Visitors can eat pancakes in the Tsar tent or have drinks in the Pushkin bar. Or possibly tea in the Vladimir Putin salon. Several members of parliament have indicated that they believe Corendon should cease the flights. NSA MP Kasper Feldkamp said the Dutch cabinet, which the head of Corendon was until recently part of, spares no effort to help Ukraine to defend itself against Russian aggression, and the fact that the Corendon subsidiary is flying back and forth to Russia to provide pleasure for tourists is incomprehensible. So, yeah, huge amount of OPEF about this. And I was just thinking, this replica of the Kremlin really caught my eye, because I thought, that would seem to me to be a perfect place to go if you were, maybe, hypothetically, planning a terrorist attack on the real Kremlin, right?
That's a good idea. Yeah. So maybe it's a sort of like an insider sort of secret mission.
Like a sort of inside job. Yeah, like a false flag operation. You could just walk around casually and saying, so if President Putin came into this room, which door would he come in through? Oh, right, okay.
And where would you be? Where would the room be underneath
Exactly.
Could I be having a massage in that room at the time?
That sort of thing. Yeah, you could get some really interesting information, I think. So.
And do they offer laser quest and things in the grounds to improve your shooting skills and stuff, do they?
I believe that drones are banned in the area, so that's got unfortunate connotations. This week, the coalition talks continue to go around in ever-decreasing circles. We found out how far Princess Amalia had to go to escape the Dutch criminal elite. Half a dozen pensioners are facing jail sentences. Amsterdam unveils its latest wheeze to drive tourists away. And we tell you why the Olympic flame was originally a beacon of socialism. But we start once again with the news that there is no news. The four right-wing parties trying to form a new government have made no visible progress whatsoever this week. The leaders were supposed to sit down and discuss migration issues on Monday, but that was abandoned in mid-afternoon when Geert Wilders walked out of the talks. The other leaders were quick to douse the flames and say it was a tactical move, and throwing toys out of the pram was a perfectly normal and healthy part of open negotiations. There were conflicting reports on whether Wilders was angry, unsatisfied, disappointed, or all three. And the negotiators said that there were heated discussions on all subjects, and that was perfectly healthy. But the parties are still seemingly miles away on asylum and migration. There are differences on agriculture, and the whole area of public finance is getting trickier by the day. But the lead negotiators insisted that the pieces of the puzzle are slowly coming together.
So how long have they still got to build this 10,000-piece puzzle then?
Yeah, it's 10,000-piece kind of replica of the Kremlin, it looks like it's becoming.
3D puzzle.
Yeah, 3D puzzle. Or maybe a replica of the renovated Binnenhof, which we'll come around to. But the deadline day is May the 15th, so they still have about 4 weeks. But according to Elbert Dijkgraaf, who is one of the two negotiators, they're now expecting the talks to go right down to the wire. There was earlier hopes that they might be have everything tied up by the May holiday recess at the end of April, but that looks increasingly unlikely. And he said he'd only know on the last day whether this round of talks is going to succeed or not.
So how are they all feeling? Are there any indications of the general mood in the camp?
Well, I mean, the parties haven't seemingly been able to agree on much so far, or even spend much time in the room together. But one thing they did agree on a few weeks ago was to tone down their behaviour on Twitter. Right? Remember this very clearly? They all stood in front of a camera and said, Geert Wilders particularly said, yes, I'm going to find it tough, but I'm going to do it for the good of the harmony in the negotiating room. And it was a clear message from the two lead negotiators to stop venting their spleen on social media. So guess what happened this week?
Go on.
Geert Wilders vented his spleen on social media, to absolutely nobody's surprise. The week's been dominated by an angry tweet by Wilders, who was triggered somewhat by the Deputy Minister for Asylum, Erik van den Burg, who was in Parliament this week in a session where I think about five MPs attended. It was also filmed and put on Geen Stijl, the shop blog, which at which point it went viral around the PVV's voters the MPs. They don't have any members. Anyway, Erik van den Burg said in Parliament that he thought it was an excellent choice that the four parties had agreed to have a cabinet without Geert Wilders as Prime Minister. And Geert Wilders then reposted this video by Geen Stijl and called van den Burg a nasty little man and said he should pack his bags quickly. This is the milder, more reasonable Geert Wilders, remember, that who's been around since last November. Pieter Omtzigt, he came out of the talks and they asked him about this and he just sort of sighed deeply and then said inappropriate and walked away. That was his only word to the cameras on, I think, Tuesday. Dylan Yeshiger said this really has to stop now, in the manner that he used to speak to a five-year-old who's refusing to go to bed. And Caroline van der Plas said she was getting a bit tired of having to react to other people's tweets on camera. But Wilders stood his ground and he said he was just objecting to Van der Burg's comment and he couldn't care less what others thought of it. He said it was wurst, or sausage. So ended another productive week at the negotiating table. On Saturday, we hit 150 days since the general election and there is still no sign of a government anytime soon.
What's the record number of days? What was it last time?
Last time they actually negotiated for some 200...
It was 10 months.
The government was actually out of office for just under a year, but that includes the time since it collapsed. I mean, this government has been a caretaker government since the 7th of July, so they could easily beat that record. Because they're going to have a job. Given they haven't even started on actually sitting down and writing a coalition agreement, they could well go up to July before they're actually ready to take over.
Maybe that's for the best. We've also had, to keep us amused in these times, the spring budget statement from the outgoing cabinet, which has no right really by precedent to do new things, certainly controversial things. Tell us about it.
They'll argue they're not doing anything controversial because nothing was declared controversial, so they have a free hand to legislate as they see fit. And also, in the absence of any kind of viable alternative, Mark Rutte's government is just getting on with the business of running the country. So the spring budget statement was published a few weeks earlier this year to give the negotiating parties time to digest it. It's safe to say it didn't go down well, certainly not with Geert Wilders, mainly because it included extra money for the overburdened refugee accommodation service and another €1 billion in aid to Ukraine, because two things that Wilders is not really enthusiastic about. The PVV voted down the Ukrainian support deal in the Senate recently, and of course extra money for asylum seekers is an absolute red line for Wilders. Rutte has said he will push for another $3 billion for Ukraine next year. I wonder why he's so keen on money for Ukraine.
Nothing to do with NATO, is it?
Surely not, no. Surely not. Nothing to do with the fact that he's expected to be the boss of NATO by next year. But, and there's also extra cash to compensate the victims of the childcare benefits scandal, the Tuslachen affair, and the Groningen earthquake damage caused by gas drilling. And there was something of a split between the negotiating parties as well. The FeFeD and NSC said they supported most of the spring budget package, but the PVV and the BBB, the Farmers' Party, were more critical. And it also, of course, creates another headache at the negotiating table because it pushes the projected budget deficit up to 3% of GDP, which is right on the European Union's kind of limit for how much governments are allowed to exceed their expenditure. And that, of course, gives the incoming government very, very little room for its own spending cuts. So, I think given that this spring budget statement has to be debated in Parliament at the start of June, we can expect some heated exchanges. The PVV might even turn up.
That would be nice. And yeah. I hear that they might also be planning their new Binnenhof when they talk about these budgets. Tell me about the bill for the renovation of the Parliament that seems to have risen.
Yeah, I think the new Binnenhof is going to have to be made of papier-mâché if they need to find any more spending cuts. Or just mud.
We can all just throw mud and make a mud wall.
We could indeed just make a big mud hut. Yeah, that would be good. Originally, the renovation of the Parliament complex was supposed to last just over 5 years and cost €475 million. Soon after the work began, that rose to just over under 900 million. And this week, Home Affairs Minister Hugo de Jonge published his latest progress report and just casually dropped the bombshell that it's now expected to cost at least €2 billion. And it will take a year longer than previously thought, so MPs won't be moving out of their temporary home at Bezuidenhoutseweg 67, which is Paul's favourite building, until 2028, which might just be in time for the conclusion of the current coalition negotiations.
Very good.
De Jonge said the high costs are unfortunate but unavoidable because the building is in a much worse state than they appreciated. They found more asbestos, they found rotting walls. The lake on the north side is leaking into the Senate, apparently, and there's also extra costs have come along. Like, for example, they now have to house all of the heating and IT facilities in a bunker because otherwise they might get hacked by the Russians or maybe the CEO of Corendon. But Hugo de Jonge said the work would ensure that the magnificent monument, which is the oldest seat of government in the world, apparently, would be fit for purpose in future.
Does it have rotten foundations as well?
Like half of the foundations.
The Economist had a wonderful piece last weekend where they estimated that the cost of climate change was huge for all kinds of countries around the world, and they reckoned that house prices in Amsterdam could drop by 40%.
Wow!
With this taken into account, that was excellent news.
Yeah, is that just because Amsterdam is just falling into the sea, basically?
Absolutely, exactly. Rather like the Binnenhof, sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. No, then the Binnenhof, I think. Well, I don't know if that's sand foundations or soil, but underneath the Binnenhof. But certainly, I mean, the fact there's a great big lake right out on the outside. You know, it's like architects always say: don't ever build a swimming pool in your basement because it's just disastrous. So it's a kind of similar thing, really. You know, if you've got a big body of water and next to an ancient building, at some you know that those two don't really live together very happily, as they're finding out.
So to raise this money, unfortunately, they won't be able to turn on the gas taps in Groningen. Tell us about the better news for the people in Groningen.
Yeah, there's certainly relief in Groningen because the Senate has finally voted to shut down gas production for good this year. And the Mines Minister Hans Feilbrief said the taps could be turned off as soon as May the 1st. The original date was going to be October the 1st. He now says that could be accelerated. And in fact, I think on Friday there was a sort of symbolic switching off of the gas taps in the very field where the first drill or the gas was first drilled in Groningen 61 years ago. Yes. 2 weeks ago, of course, there was uproar in the northern province when senators from the negotiating parties moved to delay the vote because they wanted to be sure that the gas that we would still actually have gas from somewhere once we turned it off in Groningen. But of course, the ears of people in Groningen, that sounded like a Weasley way of saying we're thinking about just not switching it off at all because it's too lucrative. And of course, gas security was one of the biggest excuses that was used back in the day for not scaling back production, even when it became clear that the earthquakes were linked to drilling and were ravaging people's homes. Feilbrief welcomed the decision. He said, Groningen's finally had the certainty they deserve, and I suspect you'll never have to buy a drink in the Drie Zusters pub ever again.
What about Ukraine?
Yeah, and there's also been some more encouraging news for Ukraine, which obviously is having things are not going well on the battlefront. The Russians seem to be advancing, and the aid is getting stuck in the pipeline. But in Romania, Defence Minister Kaisa Olonkhan was doing her best Top Gun impression. She touched down in one of three F-16 jets at the European Training Centre and did a big photo shoot in combat gear, fighter pilot gear. The planes will be used to train fighter pilots from Ukraine and other European nations so that Ukraine can finally start using F-16s in its defence against Russian missiles.
Well, let's move on to something slightly less serious and a bit more fun. Royal news. I don't know if you know what a keen royalist I am, Gordon.
I know that you're always out there on Koningsdag with your little flag and your orange hat, right?
Absolutely. And, yeah. I watch Blauwbloed, Blue Blood every weekend. I'm obsessed with royal news. Not really.
You know where the kings are going for his birthday this year, right?
I don't. Where is he going for his birthday?
He's off to Emmen.
Oh.
It's the first time he's ever been to Drenthe. So he drew the short straw because his daughter has has been somewhere a little bit more glamorous than Emin, hasn't she? We've discovered this week.
That's right. She has. She was unable to live in Amsterdam to the shock of the country. Actually, a couple of years ago in October 2022, she was one of a number of people who had death threats. They say from criminal corners, which meant that she had to move out of her student house in Amsterdam. And unknown to those criminals, actually, it turned out that she switched to Spain. She moved to Spain. For probably a year, and is now back and able to have a more normal life.
Right, and this is all fixed by the Spanish royal family, right? They sort of found some digs, and they said you can just live in Spain and study remotely, and it all sounds, obviously, it's not nice to get death threats, but, you know, as things go, I mean, I think if I was being threatened by drug criminals and the payoff was that I got to live in Madrid for a year, it's not the worst outcome, is it?
No, everything did go quiet for a while. I wonder why they came forward with it now. But anyway, Amalia's got quite a good public profile, actually. She's one of the members of the royal family who said that she'd refuse her allowance until she was actually performing royal duties when she went off to study. And she said last February that things are still very difficult for me. And her mum, Queen Maxima, much loved Queen Maxima, said very emotionally on a state visit to Sweden how difficult it was for her young daughter not to be able to go out in a normal way. And Amalia's also been praised in the past. She had a book published by comedian Claudia de Bray to celebrate her 18th birthday, and was quite open about staying mentally healthy, getting support when needed. And people were very positive about that, and hopefully that kind of attitude stood her in good stead in a difficult year.
And of course I think it came out this week, I think, because they had this photo call with the Spanish royal family, and that was about her first official public appearance, I think, because you're talking about her not taking her money until she's actually on royal duties, and that was one of her first engagements.
She's been on the lists for a few things coming up, actually, I've noticed, so I wonder if that's changing.
Yeah, so perhaps she's getting more involved in royal duties. And that is kind of kickabout in the area of Amsterdam where Johan Cruyff grew up, Tom Dorp, with the King of Spain. There's a slightly, I have to say, I don't think Johan Cruyff would have envied the ball skills of either of the two kings. But that was what they were doing. And speaking of the King and Queen, there's been some news about the big fancy dress party, or the presentation of the Prince's Dach, or what we call Budget Day. That's getting a bit of a makeover as well. Right.
Yeah, that's right. Prince's Dach, where people normally wear fancy hats and parade around, is going to get a populist makeover this year, apparently. And it's not clear if that's because the populist PVV of Geert Wilders is trying to be part of a government for the first time properly, or because the Dutch royals in general have been declining in popularity. There's less support for the amount they cost. There's a big debate about whether the king should pay tax on his 1.1 million a year package. And there's an ongoing court case about whether it's fair at all to have the king's token presence in court. So Budget Day used to involve a procession and a historic golden coach, but even the golden coach has been retired because it's got racist and colonialist murals on one side. So anyway, officials from the royal household and the parliament are making a new plan to get the public excited about Prince's Dach with some coach action, balcony scene, maybe a public concert so people are distracted and don't demonstrate as they have done in recent years. Or perhaps it's all just a big distraction from the fact that this budget's going to be a disaster because the new government's got to come up with savings of 17 billion if there is a new government by then, and the tax office is in complete disarray, and it's doubtful whether there'll even be a government formed by then at all.
Are you going to be out in Amsterdam next Saturday? Have you got any tat that you need to sell to your neighbours?
Yes, that's right, because King's Day is our next royalist occasion where we all wear orange and pray to the king. I'm not sure, actually. I normally do an English cake stall, so my plan is somewhat scuppered for that.
I think you might. Yeah, well, I think you just need to sort of do it in disguise or pass the cakes on. You have to come up with some kind of a tax construction, right, where you sell the cakes via an offshore trust. And then you'll be okay.
Start a new company that is based at the same address as me, but is completely different.
Exactly, but actually just sells cakes in Turkey. Yeah, and just route it through them. Then you'll be okay.
Yeah, that'd be fine. With Russian sauce.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Exactly. Yeah, but no Russian tea, please. Prosecutors have asked for sentences of up to 2.5 years in jail to be imposed on 6 pensioners who distributed a suicide powder known as Substance X. A 7th person, Petra de Jong, who's also on trial, is expected to be acquitted after the prosecution said they found no evidence that she actually distributed the powder. But she and the other 6 are all members or former members of an organisation called the Last Will Cooperative, which campaigns for people's rights to choose when to die. None of them have been in trouble with the police before, but the prosecution said that they should be regarded as a criminal organisation because of the structured way in which they arrange for people to obtain the cocktail of drugs known as Substance X. And one of the defendants, 80-year-old Luc de L, is said to have given the powder to 600 people in meetings at their homes. He acquired it from another member of the group called Alex S, who was jailed for 3.5 years in 2023 for supplying the compound. A verdict in the current case is expected in July.
So what do the defendants say?
Well, they say they're not a criminal organisation, they're a campaign group, and they want people to be able to make their own decision about when to die, and also that they've been campaigning for a legal suicide pill. And they say that all they did was give people information on Substance X, but the prosecution said that it went further than that, and it amounted to assisted suicide, because they give detailed instructions of where to buy the powder and how to put it together. Although euthanasia is legal in the Netherlands, it can only be carried out by a doctor under strict conditions at the request of the patient. The prosecution's argument is that the cooperative didn't abide by these standards. They decided who could get the powder, regardless of their age or their mental condition. It's also emerged that Substance X isn't as benign as it was made out to be. Some people take as long as 40 hours to die after taking it, and the government has published a page on its website listing the side effects, which include irregular heartbeat, chest pains, vomiting and diarrhea.
Well, it's not exactly benign if it's supposed to kill you anyway, but I suppose the aim is to have a painless death.
The aim is to go away, yes, it's to pass away quietly, and apparently that in many cases that doesn't happen, yeah.
Do we know how many people have actually died after taking this Substance X, which the media is obviously not naming for reasons of responsibility?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Apparently it is quite freely available. It's also a chemical compound that's used in the chemical industry, and buying it is not illegal, but obviously buying it with the intent of taking your own life and at least 172 people in the Netherlands have died as a result of taking the powder since 2015. Those figures were published by the suicide helpline Stichting 113 Selfmoord Preventie and Amsterdam's local health board. So there were figures, but they hadn't been published before, but then they came out with them because there'd been reports in the media saying that there weren't any figures available. Although the largest group of people were in their 70s, who made up just under 2/5 of the total, a quarter were aged between 30 and 50, and 70% had some kind of history of psychiatric treatment. Also, 19% of those people, the psychiatric patients, had requested euthanasia, but in half of those cases, their request had been refused. So at that point, they then went out and ordered their suicide powder online.
Yeah, and this is another debate, of course, in the Netherlands. The euthanasia law is open to people who have suffering for psychiatric reasons, but there's a long process to get it. Quite rightly so, there are high thresholds and a strong duty of care, because, of course, one of the symptoms of some psychiatric conditions can be a death wish if people are deeply depressed. And so it needs to be distinguished by the doctor whether someone actually has a long held wish for death, doesn't really have any other alternatives, and that's clearly harder to judge with certain conditions rather than something like terminal cancer is quite straightforward. So that's another debate in the Netherlands, actually. What do you do about people who have a death wish? And it's very interesting that at the same time as some people are campaigning for more access to euthanasia for people whose psychiatric state of mind is such that they have almost 100% chance that they're never going to get better and they want euthanasia. And this court case against people who have allegedly been involved with distributing a suicide powder. It's very interesting. It's not illegal to take your own life in the Netherlands, but it is illegal to help someone else do it, because the euthanasia law, there's only an exemption for doctors helping somebody else.
And even then, the euthanasia always has to be vetted by the prosecution service. They have to be completely satisfied that the rules are followed strictly. I think there has been one case of a doctor being prosecuted.
There have been a couple of cases of prosecution. There was a prosecution about a case in 1991 for psychiatric reasons. A doctor helped a woman in her 50s to end her life on her request. And actually, that doctor himself is now ambivalent about the levels of euthanasia for people with mental health problems. This is a very difficult area, and some people are concerned that we're missing signals that social support and care for people in society is just not good enough.
Yeah, it is difficult. I think certainly as well, people, I think sometimes blithely assume that that we almost have euthanasia on demand now. But doctors will say that it's always a very difficult process. They don't like doing it. They don't see it as the reason they went into the profession, obviously. But then most doctors will face a handful of euthanasia requests every year, and it's always a very stressful moment for them. So it is a thing that they take that responsibility very, very seriously. And there is also always a dilemma of on the one hand, you want to ensure that people who are suffering with no prospect of relief do have that option, but also that you do actually exhaust all the alternatives first,
and that you don't simply say, okay, we're not going to improve this expensive care system because people have this other option. That would be a shocking thing.
It would, of course. But on the other hand, of course, you don't want to prolong people's suffering either. So it's an ongoing dilemma. We're not planning to relocate to Spain anytime soon, but there are some costs involved in making this podcast, and we're not just talking about our emotional well-being. So we're very grateful indeed to the support of our generous patrons, and as ever, this is the point in the podcast where we take a minute to say thank you to those of us who support us, and have you considered donating via our Patreon page to the others. Our patrons get access to our bonus content. You can ask us your questions about anything under the sun, but preferably relating to the Netherlands, and extra votes in the hotly contested OPEF of the Year awards. And as you also, of course, get a shout out when you sign up to say thank you for your support. And this week we say hello and thank you to new patron Caitlin McCarthy. So thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you,
to
Caitlin.
You. Yeah. And a special thanks as well to everyone who took time out to comment on our last bonus episode about the verzuiling system, the pillarization that dominated Dutch society up until the mid-20th century, which we really enjoyed making and seems to have struck a chord with anyone who's ever taken a citizenship class.
Don't think pillarization's ever really gone away, has it?
It's an astonishingly
segregated society.
I think it arguably takes different forms these days. So there's certainly lots of relics of it lying around in various places. We also heard from Nick Pernisco, who became a patron last week, and he tells us that he lived in Amsterdam for a year until 2019, and he really liked it. And he and his wife would like to move permanently one day, but they're currently living in Seattle. He's also become a big Ajax fan, which I think is in 2018 that was quite a attractive thing to be, but unfortunately things have been just going downhill ever since. And he says, what will it take to get Ajax back on track? Do they need to fire some administrators? Well, we are going to talk about Ajax a bit later in the sports section, but yeah, I think the administrations are in the business of firing themselves at the moment. That just seems
Absolutely.
To be descending into civil war. So, and I think ultimately Ajax, I mean, they are still the biggest and richest club in the Netherlands. This is not going to be, you know, this is a temporary setback for them, but it is at the same time very entertaining for even people who don't like football, perhaps. I don't know. To see Ajax in meltdown. No, Shen's shaking you. You're shaking your head.
I think we should just get to tile whipping. It's more exciting as a kind of national competition.
But maybe they just need to rip up the stadium. Yeah, have a whole group of volunteers just rip up the stadium and start again.
I think they do. Maybe they need to be lay some better grass, get some more absorbency in there, bit of exercise.
Yeah, well, there was a problem with the grass when they actually built the Johan Cruyff Arena back in the 90s, because the stadium was so big, they were expecting so many fans that the grass never got any sunshine. It wasn't growing.
Rather like the rest of the Netherlands.
Exactly, yeah, basically. Yeah, which is only going to get worse, according to, if you looked out the window the last couple of months. We have four tiers of membership to suit all budgets, so if you're not supporting us yet, why not hop along to www.patreon.com/nutsnewsnl and join our army of sponsors.
And in the meantime, have a little think about tourism in Amsterdam. In the selection of 100 new rules to crack down on nuisance tourism, our favourite city, Amsterdam, has aimed its sights on one of the primary troublemaking groups. Yeah. Can you guess, Gordon?
Is it Brits getting sloshed and falling into canals?
No, it is old people going on river cruises.
Of course it is, yeah.
Of course it is. The city wants to halve the number of cruises going through the Dutch capital to 1,150 a year by 2028 as one of the measures to stop over-tourism.
Yeah, they've had their guard down too long, the old tourists, right?
They are notorious troublemakers. I can tell you actually with inside knowledge because my mum has several times been on one of these cruises, typically 55 plus. They go to visit cultural sites like museums. They spend huge amounts of money on radically overpriced restaurants with shoddy food. And they typically have a night in one of Amsterdam's hotels before the cruise starts where they watch television until late at night and maybe they have a glass of wine. Yeah. Anyway, businesses have told the city that cracking down on these rich, well-behaved, well-mannered cultural tourists...
who spend lots of money in the city and pay lots of tourist tax, so we don't want them.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's going to lose the city $63 million a year.
Is it because when they actually get off the boat and walk about the streets, they get in the way of the cyclists? Is this the problem?
Funny you should say this, that you really, as a cyclist, you have to start shouting a kilometre in advance. Hurry up across the road there! Yes, possibly. One hotelier is pointing out, look, if these people aren't in rooms, the rooms will just be filled with less desirable tourists, the ones who actually do drugs, leer around the red light district and vomit on your doorstep.
But that's not the only measure that Amsterdam's come up with to destroy its tourism industry, right?
Yes, exactly. No. The city is last year famously did a stay away campaign telling nuisance Brits that you mentioned to stay away. Yeah. They're expanding this campaign to other nuisance nations like the French, Germans and others, although it sounds a bit like an infringement of European freedom of movement rules.
Yeah.
And they studiously fail to address the fact that their own research shows that the joint biggest troublemakers with the Brits are the Dutch young men between 18 and 34, who also have a big mouth when you ask them to be quiet, by the way. Anyway, last year they told the British thugs to stay away. They've recently launched a questionnaire telling you all the things that you can't do, including stag trips. And one company tells me that inspired a spike in bookings for his stag company. There's a ban on smoking cannabis in public. There's shorter bar opening times.
Yeah, and they're relocating the whole red light district right out of the city centre. Yeah,
half of it. They're trying, if it ever happens.
Yeah. So has this had any effect so far on actually dampening tourism or encouraging people to go and take their city breaks elsewhere?
Funnily enough... the figures released by the city this week showed that it broke its own promise to limit tourist overnights to 20 million last year. It broke the barrier. And that doesn't even include Airbnb or all these cruises. That's just the hotel.
All right.
And excellent news, there are still another 26 hotels which have planning permission and are being built. Terrific. Yeah. It's despite the fact that they're not supposed to be allowed anymore. Planning takes so long that they were already going through the system. So we really need that space, obviously, to go to tourists, given that house prices have trebled since 2013 and it's impossible to find a reasonably priced flat. So it's great times for landlords and the tourist industry. And I think we should actually blame the people who are responsible
for everything.
For everything wrong.
For everything's gone wrong in Amsterdam.
Yeah. It's the expats.
Of course it
is.
They should give themselves a big slap on the wrist. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I wonder. I mean, I was just thinking maybe in about 10 years' time, just as Groningen is having a sort of symbolic switching off of the gas taps, is Amsterdam going to go back to the very first hotel room in 10 years' time and evict the last tourist from the city and celebrate the fact that nobody is visiting and will visit ever again?
Just don't mention the war.
Yes.
Exodus of populations, huh?
No. Sports news, and I thought we'd start with an Olympic tale this week and staying in Amsterdam as well, because the Olympic flame was lit at Olympia in Greece this week, 100 days before the opening ceremony in Paris. The flame will go on a torch relay around France from May the 8th, including the French overseas territories, so places like French Guiana, Réunion and New Caledonia, great celebration of colonialism. And the last stage will be a tour of the Paris metropolitan area, ending up in the Olympic Stadium on July the 26th, when the flame will be lit for the Games. What does all this have to do with the Netherlands, you may be asking? Well,
yes, I'm asking that.
Good, I thought you were. And that's good for the script as well. The Olympic flame was actually revived for the Games by a Dutchman, an architect called Jan Vils, for the Amsterdam Olympics in 1928. He didn't invent the torch relay. That was an idea brought in by the Nazis in 1936. But he did build the Olympic Stadium, which is still there, complete with a 40-metre-high marathon tower. And he wanted the flame to burn to let everyone around the city know that the Games are taking place.
And was that the only reason, or did he have some kind of hidden woke agenda? Did the flame have another meaning?
Yeah, it wasn't the only reason. Vils was a socialist, and he wanted to noise up the Christians. I see some of Amsterdam's more devout politicians, precursors of the Christian Democrats, frowned on the Olympics because they saw it as a heathen festival.
Oh, so, like the cakes on Koningsdag.
Just like the cakes on Koningsdag, yeah. They wanted to, yeah, they didn't approve of all this at all. So Vils had the idea of building this tower that would stand alongside the city's church towers and then stick a giant heathen burning flame on top. And so he got that, and he also got an Olympic gold medal. Because back in those days, they awarded gold medals for art, poetry, and sculpture, and architecture, as well as running, swimming, and smacking balls around. And I think that's an idea we should revive, having gold medals for the arts. Yeah,
journalists.
Yes.
Anyway, coming back to 2024, how are the Dutch athletes likely to do this summer?
The sports data bureau and Nielsen have crunched the numbers, and they're predicting a record haul for the Dutch team in Paris. I think they predicted that last time as well. I don't know.
Maybe they get more money if they predict a record haul.
I can't believe you think this is some kind of publicity gimmick, Shen. But anyway, according to the Grace Note system, the team can look forward to winning 38 medals across 13 sports, which would be two more than in Tokyo 3 years ago. 3 years because, of course, the last Olympics were delayed by the coronavirus pandemic. The favourites include Famke Ball in the 400 metres, Sifan Hassan over the longer distances, although she hasn't made up her mind which races she's actually going to do, because she can do anything from like 1500 metres to the marathon. And Harry Leveisen, who's tipped to get three gold medals in the indoor cycling. However, the chef de mission.
It's all like the flat sports, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And but being good on bikes as well.
And the tiles get in the way. So once you've ripped them off.
Once you've ripped up the tiles, it becomes an obstacle course, which I guess is why the Dutch have been good at BMX recently as well.
Oh, really?
Interesting. Yeah, it's become a thing. However, the chef de mission, Peter van den Hoogenband, he said the Olympics is about stories, not medals, which is easy for you to say, Peter van den Hoogenband, when you've already won three gold medals. And the Dutch Olympic Committee says finishing in the top 10 nations is no longer its main priority.
Because it won't.
According to Grace Note, they're going to be the fourth best nation. So, we'll see. I think they did finish. I can't remember if they were they were 10th or 11th or 12th last time. They're very close to the top 10 anyway.
It's just because other countries have too many hills, so they have an unfair advantage in all the flat sports.
Yeah, exactly. Anything
it's
that's
kind
on
of like
a track.
A genetic advantage.
Yeah, and obviously swimming as well. The Dutch tend to be good swimmers because they've all got their swim diplomas as well. So, it's kind of cheating, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's cheating. Anyway, who's not going to be winning? Do tell, Gordon.
Yeah, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, he's not going to win any medals, but he has said he's going to take a dip in the river during the Olympics.
God, don't do that. It's quite polluted, isn't it?
Well, this is the thing, you see. You know, he says, and the Paris officials have been saying, no, they've been very, very busy cleaning up the river. So he wants to highlight the fact that it is now safe to swim in, a bit like, you remember John Gummer, right? The British agriculture minister.
What did he do? They mess up, don't they, one way or another?
He fed a beef burger to his daughter reassure everyone that British beef was safe in the 1990s. And of course, we subsequently
We
subsequently discovered that Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease actually was not safe at all, very sadly, for the people who've died from it. So, yeah, this is Emmanuel Macron going for a swim to tell everyone that the river is safe. I don't know about you, but I thought when I heard about this, I thought Emmanuel Macron must be quite literally in Seine.
Oh, dear, that's dreadful.
Christmas crackers have come early.
All right, come on, you've been waiting to tell me. Tell me what's going on in the Ajax saga that I'm completely uninterested in, but some of our patron supporters are.
Yeah, they're very keen to know what's happening at Ajax, and things are just getting unravelling by the day, basically. I mean, last week we brought you the news that three members of Ajax's supervisory board have stepped down in the wake of the decision to suspend Alex Kroes, the new CEO. That over allegations of insider trading, Kroes bought 17,500 shares in the club 1 week before he was publicly unveiled as the new chief executive in August last year. He insists he's done nothing wrong.
Because it was club... registered to a different address, right?
Probably,
the same
yeah.
address, but a different company.
Yeah. Registered to somebody called Alex Turkey Kroes or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, he insists he's done nothing wrong. The club's hardcore fans seem to be taking his side, but they unveiled banners at the weekend match against SC Twente calling for Michael van Praag, who is the chair of the supervisory board, to quit. And Van Praag is now likely to face some tough questions at an extraordinary shareholders meeting on May the 21st, which was originally convened to discuss Kroes' sacking. Van Praag was also accused this week of double standards after it turned out he bought 100 shares in the club when it was listed on the stock exchange in 1998, but he didn't declare them in time. Van Praag has blamed the club for the error. He said it was an administrative omission, and he says he still intends to move for Kroes to be sacked at the shareholders' meeting. Perhaps Van Praag, I don't know, bought some cakes from the Ajax shop and didn't declare them as well. Maybe that's going to be the next scandal, I don't know. Some club members say the board should wait for a ruling from the financial markets regulator AFM, but in any case, this is just going to run on and on, basically.
Now, the script is telling me that I'm supposed to ask you if there's any other football news, but really, okay, go on then, make me suffer it.
Right, football news, yeah. Well, there's no Dutch clubs in the Champions League or the other European competitions. PSV, they're strolling to the league title. That's not very exciting. There was worries that Vitesse Arnhem might go out of business, but they now say they expect to survive till the end of the season, despite their deep, deep financial troubles. But the relegation does look a certainty. It's a cup final on Sunday. Feyenoord taking on NEC Nijmegen, who have lost five times in the final so far and are hoping to buck that trend for the sixth time of asking. But there's one piece of genuinely exciting football news, which is the men's indoor team have qualified for the World Cup for the first time in 24 years. This is futsal, so you know, football in the gym, basically, just like you used to play at school.
Oh, no, but this is not good news because they beat my mother nation.
I'm afraid so,
Finland.
yes.
This is not okay.
No, they want to play.
I might not care about football, but I care about Finland.
Well, I'm afraid you're not going to see them in Uzbekistan in September because they've lost the World Cup qualifying playoff
to
the Netherlands.
Were the Dutch cheating?
Well, I don't know, but they were losing 3-2 until 5 seconds from the end of the match when they managed to squeeze in an equaliser.
Hmm.
And then they took the lead next to time, but the Finns equalised with 1 second on the clock. So, but then the Dutch managed what their outdoor players can never do, which is they won a penalty shootout. So they will now be off, and not the Finns, to Uzbekistan on September the 14th, which is where the Futsal World Cup finals begin.
Does Corindon fly there?
Probably, yeah.
It's that time of year again, actually, and the king with his visit to Drenthe might enjoy it for tulips and bulbs. And in the town hall of Sassenheim, there's a familiar smell descending, actually flooding over the whole place. There's a massive hall, hundreds of volunteers, a choir, and all the different provinces are competing to win a prize for the best stand, which isn't actually a static stand. It's kind of a rebuilt vehicle covered with flowers. On Saturday, there's going to be a procession of these weird and wonderful creations through the Bollestreek as part of the Blumenkorso.
The Blumenkorso. So how did all this begin?
Funnily enough, after the war, it turns out that a flower grower called Willem Warmenhoven from Hillegom decided that everyone needed cheering up and needed a bit of joy. And he organised the first Blumenkorso, the flower parade, in 1947. It actually turns out that many of these flowers that are used are not a spectacular waste of flowers, as you might think, but a byproduct, because the growing is happening for the bulbs, which are then going to be sold.
Right.
And the first set of flowers would be thrown away in some cases. Anyway, okay. So he grew hyacinths and amaryllis, and his grandson's apparently still involved in the flower business, and the family were along there watching the stands being built this year.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Obviously, this came about in 1947, just a couple of years after people were eating flower bulbs to live, but that didn't put them off. Seemingly, they really got stuck into it, and it's grown ever since.
Yeah.
So, what do this year's entries look like?
Yeah, you can go and watch them doing the build in this hall. It's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. There's this massive elephant, complete with that well-known Dutch product, bananas. What does that make you think of, Gordon? Bananas.
Yes,
more
bananas,
normally in the news for hiding cocaine, which I'm not suggesting, of course, is anything to do with their stand. There's all kinds of animals. There's, I don't know even how many flowers there are, maybe a million. I mean, there's huge numbers of flowers, and actually quite a lot discarded, because it turns out that the wet weather has been disastrous for hyacinths. So they're having to throw away 95% of the hyacinths that has come in this year. They're all sort of rotten. You can't build, can't pick them well when it's wet. Anyway, there's all these people climbing around up ladders on planks in these most precarious positions, creating these marvellous creations. And North Holland, for the first time, is using organic flowers and an electric vehicle.
Ah, so very sustainable of them. Good on them.
Yeah.
There's some bad news for hyacinths, but other flowers seem to be not doing so well either, like lilies, apparently.
Lilies, yeah. Well, North Holland's stall is quite interesting, actually, because there's increasing concerns in the Netherlands about the flower trade and the use of pesticides, because flowers are very vulnerable to disease. People want them to be perfect. And farmers, especially of lilies, typically use a cocktail of products to prevent fungus and bugs. And lilies are grown outside. The Netherlands is a small and heavily populated country, and people get quite worried about this. People living nearby a bulb grower, Peter van Meijl in Zevenum in Limburg, were in court actually on Thursday, concerned about whether the spraying of these lily bulbs could affect the health of their children. Scientific experts and some investigative journalists say that while there's some evidence linking certain pesticides potentially with neurological diseases like Parkinson's, the Dutch rules, European rules actually overall, simply don't test for this. And also no one really knows the impact of a kind of cocktail of pesticides, even if the individual ones are allowed. And there's no suggestion that the farmers are doing something that isn't allowed by law, but there are suggestions that the law is in some respects full of holes, including from the main authority that that governs these laws in the Netherlands, which has contacted Europe to ask for more investigation and more rules on the links between certain pesticides and Parkinson's. Pretty eminent scientists like Bas Bloem say there needs to be more action at a European level.
A flower expert called Bas Bloem?
He is indeed called Bas Bloem. Yes, yes. Like the lady from De Haan, who the lady called The Hen, who works for a poultry association. Yeah. Yes, yes. Anyway, so go and have a look at the flowers and the Corso, maybe on TV, and maybe get inspired to grow your own flowers at home in the meantime.
Yeah, and use organic fertilizer rather than pesticides.
Yeah, ladybirds.
Yes, exactly.
Bugs.
Bugs to eat other bugs, yeah. Yeah,
yes, exactly.
I tried to do that one time. Remember, I ordered some ladybirds online to try and eat the bugs, and I stuck them in the plants, and they all immediately just flew away.
And, that's not so good. They're investigating about this in the University of Wageningen, and they've got this bug army, they call it, that they're using on their gerberas to try to eat the caterpillars and things. But the only trouble, it strikes me, is if you're buying a nice bunch of flowers for your mum or something, what you really don't want is a massive spider crawling out at her.
Not really, no. Yeah.
It's going to defeat the object.
Yeah. That's all we have for you this week. This podcast is a production of Dutch News, which can be found online at dutchnews.nl. We will include links to everything we've talked about today in the liner notes. You can get in touch with us by email to podcast@dutchnews.nl. And if you want to help us out, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating. You can also back us on Patreon at patreon.com/dutchnewsnl. Earn yourself a shout out on the podcast and access to all our wonderful bonus content. My thanks to Shanai Bostes. I'm Gordon Darroch, and Paul and I will be back next week. Thank you.